I'd like to leave something on because I'm going to write on the board a little bit.
What do you think?
Okay, we'll figure it out. Okay, so again, I'd like to thank Peter and John and Eugenia for the opportunity to speak this morning. So like the other morning speakers, what I'd like to do today is just give you an overview of some of the material that's going to show up in talks later today. So material that will be used by Danny and Urs later, and unfortunately no longer by Andre Henriquez. And in fact, when I heard on Monday, Tuesday, whenever it was that we arrived, that he was not going to be here, I sent him email to ask him what it was that he would like to convey if he were here. And so I have some sort of slogans that he would like to have shared with all of us if he had been here. So maybe at the end what I'll do is I'll give you an idea of the flavor of what he was thinking of when he did his work that's complementary to some of the material that I'll be speaking about this morning. So unlike some of the other speakers who gave survey talks about material that was not their own, I did have a hand in some of this work that I'll be speaking about, but I'd like to point out that none of this is new. Okay, so this is all about a year and a half old now, but again, I'd like to remind you of this work to, again, set us up for the talks later today. As John pointed out, I realized that this is the higher gauge theory physics day, and I am first to point out that I am not a physicist. So please don't be scared. A little secret, today's going to be a lot of math, not a lot of physics. So you don't have much. Okay. Yeah. So you don't have much to worry about. We could vote. Yeah, let's vote. Okay. No problem. But because today is the physics higher gauge theory day, I feel a little bit compelled to pretend to be a physicist for at least a little bit. So I'll tell you a teeny tiny bit about physics, and I must say that I'm a bit apprehensive about doing this because people like John and Urs and Dan and other folks will probably be cringing and want to just leap out of their seat and come to the board and do a much better job than I will. But you know what? Tough. I'm the one up here, so I get to say what I'd like. So this is my token physics discussion. So maybe even before I get to this, maybe I should say that what I'd like to do is answer the question for you, why should we care about categorifying Lie theory? Why would one want to do that? If you spend enough time with John, like, for instance, if you were one of his grad students, you learn lots of things about him. You know, apparently he has aspirations to live in the White House, and he likes to spread the idea of categorifying all of mathematics. I realize I might be preaching to the choir, right? This is an audience that's category theorists, so you're already on board. I mean, you're just as happy to categorify as my first semester calculus students are to continue to differentiate something once they know how to do that. But I took a little convincing at first, right? I wasn't on board and needed some reason to want to generalize Lie theory. And so what I'd like to do is just give you an idea of, you know, what got me on board, what convinced me, and then hopefully that will be enough motivation for you to realize that this was a reasonable thing to do. So let's start with ordinary gauge theory. So ordinary gauge theory tells us how to take zero-dimensional point particles and transform them along a one-dimensional path. And so in this situation, it's natural to assign a group element to each path, and then composition of paths corresponds to multiplication in the group, and traversing the path backwards corresponds to taking inverses, and the associative law makes this triple composite unambiguous. So what we're seeing here is that the topology is exactly telling us the algebra. So the group laws are being expressed, or the group axioms are being expressed exactly through the topology. Well, please.
When you say you take zero-dimensional point particles and transform them along a path,
transforming a particle mean?
That's an excellent question. Remember, I'm not a physicist. So, you know, what I think of as moving zero-dimensional point particles through space-time to a new location, is that sufficient?
Okay.
Right. Is that sufficient? Okay. Where was I? Right. So nature likes groups. Right, group theory is all about symmetry, and forces in nature are described using groups. So, like, the electromagnetic force is described using the group U1, which is just the circle. And because we have the presence of geometry and calculus, not only are these groups, but they're Lie groups. So, in fact, gauge theory uses Lie groups to describe the transformation of zero-dimensional point particles along one-dimensional paths. You know, it's somewhat unnatural to reduce everything in nature to just a single point particle. So what we'd like to do is we'd like to not only talk about moving around zero-dimensional points, but also one-dimensional strings, that we'd like to group these together. And in order to do so, what we're going to need to do then is generalize the notion of a group, and in particular a Lie group, because all of these groups that nature likes are Lie groups. Okay, so that's where this higher gauge theory comes in. So the goal of higher gauge theory is to, whereas ordinary gauge theory used group theory, in particular Lie group theory, to talk about all of this and describe it, higher gauge theory will use higher dimensional group theory, in particular higher dimensional Lie groups, in order to describe this higher process. So hopefully you're a bit on board then as to why we might want to categorify Lie groups. Where do the Lie algebras come into the picture? Well, in ordinary Lie theory, it's often difficult to work with Lie groups. And so a powerful tool to work with or describe Lie groups is to instead use their Lie algebras. And what that allows us to do is reduce the problem from a group theoretic problem to a problem in linear algebra. And so working with a Lie group or Lie algebra is often much easier than working with a Lie group. And so therefore, we'd like to also categorify the notion of a Lie algebra as well. Okay, so hopefully now we've decided that categorifying Lie theory is a reasonable and interesting thing to do. So now what? Well, when we categorify a concept, what we'd like to do is we'd like to form a hybrid of that concept together with the notion of a category. And one way to do this is using a technique or a process called internalization that was developed by Erismann and also Lovier. So the idea behind this is the following. We start with some mathematical concept, and we express it purely in a diagrammatic form. We then take those diagrams and interpret them in some category of our choosing. Of course, when this ambient category K is the category of sets, we just get back or recover the concept that we started with. So we're interested in starting with the definition of a category, actually a small category, a category where the collection of objects and morphisms are sets, and then interpreting those things in other categories K. So we call a category in K, well, it goes by other names as well, a category object in K or an internal category in K. So we would write out the definition of a category completely in terms of commutative diagrams, and then go around interpreting that in categories of our choosing. Now, this is a wonderful place to start the categorification process, but it's limited by the fact that what we wind up with once we've done this is something that's strict. So all of the laws continue to hold on the nose as equations, and so somehow this isn't exactly what we're looking for. Like, we want to have something be as completely general as possible, right? The idea of category theory is that it's bad to impose laws or equations between things. We'd like this to be more general. So that's a limitation of this internalization process. So for example, a strict two group is a category living in the category of groups. Our goal, though, is to talk about categorified Lie theory. So let's start there. And let's start with this easy method of categorifying. Let's internalize. So what we'd like to do is we'd like to talk about a Lie 2 group and a Lie 2 algebra, both being strict. And these will both be categories in the category of Lie groups and Lie algebras respectively. It turns out that strictly two groups and strictly two algebras are related to special sort of cross modules. This is something that both Danny and Urs will be using and talking about later. And this relation to cross modules is what allows us to come up with examples of strictly two groups. So we have the automorphism two groups. The objects are automorphisms of G. The morphisms are formed using the action of automorphisms on the group. We have the shifted U1. We have the tangent two group, where we're using the adjoint representation of a Lie group on its Lie algebra. And then finally, the Poincaré two group, where the space of objects is the Lorentz group, and then the morphisms are this Poincaré group. So if we look back over to the slide here, the situation here is very nice. So the results of normal Lie theory, which says that any finite dimensional Lie group has a Lie algebra, continues to hold in this categorified world as well. So strict Lie two groups have strict Lie two algebras. And we go from a strict Lie two group to a strict Lie two algebra exactly as you would imagine. We just differentiate. Okay. So again, the story here is very nice, but what we're trying to do is we're trying to categorify Lie theory. And so because the most common applications in nature are more general, we need to weaken things a little bit. So let's start on the process of doing that. Okay, so just as every Lie group has an underlying, every Lie algebra has an underlying vector space, every categorified Lie algebra will have an underlying categorified vector space. And there are a couple of different notions of categorified vector spaces running around. Kapranov and Voivodsky decided to implement the idea of a two-vector space by defining a finite-dimensional two-vector space to be a category of the form vec to the n. This is analogous to how finite-dimensional vector spaces are of the form k to the n for some ground field k. Now, this definition has proven to be useful in topological field theory and also group representation theory, but unfortunately, we can't use this definition to talk about higher Lie theory because it's limited by the fact that it doesn't have a functor playing the role of subtraction. And in Lie algebras, the bracket is defined to be this commutator. It's the difference between x, y, and yx if we're taking the bracket of x and y. So this definition of a two-vector space won't work for our purposes. Moreover, Barrett and Mackay observed that Lie two groups have sort of boring representations on these two vector spaces defined by Kapranov and Voivodsky. So all of this together inspired a new definition of a two vector space, and these are internal categories or categories in the category of vector spaces. So a two vector space is just a category where everything in sight is linear. Okay. So let's just go through the definition completely. We have a vector space of objects and morphisms. All of the category operations are linear. And remember what we're doing. We're taking the definition of a category completely expressed in terms of commutative diagrams, which we're now interpreting in the world of vector spaces. So we have these laws specifying the source and target of identity morphisms, telling us how composites should work. And we also have the associative laws in the left and the right unit laws. And again, just as a reminder, while these new two vector spaces do provide us with a way to subtract things, it really is limited by the fact that these are strict. So all of the laws continue to hold on the nose as equations. This may not turn out to be the idea of a two-vector space that we'll want in the future for things such as representations of Lie two algebras. It's unclear at this point. Yes?
How do you come up with the
Yeah, you're still in my thunder. So the question was, how are these related to chain complexes? And that's the next slide. So yeah, thanks. Before I move on to that, though, I would like to say that there has been work done with these two vector spaces, these internal categories. So Elgeta has a paper where he talks about representation theory of two groups on these two vector spaces. Gautam used these two vector spaces to construct two-dimensional extended TQFTs. And just in December, Niels, with two of his collaborators, explored two vector bundles and 2K theory, both with these two vector spaces and also with Kapanov and Voivodsky's definition of two vector spaces. So perhaps later he might have something to say about that. Just as we were able to internalize the definition of a category, we can also internalize the definition of a functor and natural transformations between those. What we do is we just take these and stuff them inside the category of vect, just as before. So really, the theory of two vector spaces is just taking the theory of categories and shoving it inside the world of vector spaces. And as was pointed out, these two vector spaces really aren't anything that you're not already familiar with. So the two categories of two vector spaces, linear functors and linear transformations, just amounts to, well, it's sort of overkill for me to say that these are chain complexes, right? They're just a pair of vector spaces together with a linear map between them. Because of this arbitrary cutoff at this low dimension, we don't have a differential. D squared is not equal to zero. We don't have D squared. But we have these baby chain complexes together with chain maps and chain homotopies between them. And because it's going to be useful later on, I'd like to just take a minute to show you how to transfer between a two-vector space and a two-term chain complex. Because, again, when I talk about the proof of a theorem involving Lie 2 algebras, it'll be useful to know this. So could someone maybe hit the lights? So given a two-vector space V, we construct a two-term chain complex C. So the zero chains are exactly the objects of our two-vector space. The one chains are what we call the arrow parts of morphisms. So what are these? These are morphisms in the kernel of the source map. So given any morphism F from X to Y, its arrow part is from 0 to Y minus X. So taking the arrow part just has the effect of translating a morphism to the origin. And then what else do I need here? The differential is the target restricted to these one chains. I'm going the other way. Given a two-term chain complex, we get a two-vector space V with the objects of our two-vector space being the zero chains. The morphisms will be a zero chain together with a one chain. So what this is telling us is that we can recover any morphism from its source and its arrow part. And then the relationship between the differential and the target in the source maps is that the difference, the target minus the source, gives us the differential. It's this fact here and these arrow parts that we're going to be talking about later. So that's why I wanted to make a point of bringing this up. Okay, if it's easier for you to see without the light, feel free to turn those back off. Okay. And of course, there's no need to stop at two vector spaces, right? We can talk about n vector spaces where we take a strict n category and stuff it inside the world of vector spaces, and these are just n-term chain complexes. Oh, thank you, Jeff. Another nice thing about these two vector spaces in particular is that we were able to categorify many of the results that we know from linear algebra. So we have a direct sum and a tensor product on these two vector spaces. Of course, because they're secretly chain complexes and we know how to take the direct sum and the tensor product of chain complexes, we were able to use that. So the direct sum is exactly the same as the direct sum of chain complexes, but the tensor product involves a cutoff. Since we don't have any two chains lurking around. We also have an identity for the tensor product. It's what we're calling this capital K, which is a categorified version of the ground field. So far the story has been very nice, right? Everything has been strict. Everything has worked out the way that we wanted in terms of the Lie groups and the Lie 2 groups and the Lie 2 algebras. So what we'd like to do is weaken this and see what happens. Okay, so to define a weakened Lie 2 algebra, what we're going to do is we're going to start with one of these two vector spaces, but then we're going to weaken the Lie algebra laws. So the two vector space is strict, but we're going to introduce some weakness by weakening the Jacobi identity of the Lie algebra. So we start with our two vector space. We equip it with a bracket functor. So this is allowed to eat objects and morphisms in a pair of an object and a morphism. Notice that this is skew symmetric, so we don't weaken the anti-symmetry of the bracket. Therefore, maybe a better name for this structure would be a semi-strict Leibniz 2 algebra. Leibniz algebras are Lie algebras where the bracket is not skew symmetric. And another comment about that is perhaps this structure, this semi-strict Lie 2 algebra, isn't the most weak version of a Lie 2 algebra that we're looking for. I'll say more about that a little bit later on. We replace the Jacobi identity by the Jacobiator. So the Jacobiator is analogous to the associator. And just like the associator needs to satisfy the Pentagon identity, the Jacobiator has to satisfy a law of its own called the Jacobiator identity. Which is impossible to read. Yeah, so what does the Jacobiator do? It gives us two ways of using the Jacobiator to re-bracket an expression involving four terms. So if you think about the associator, or the Pentagon identity, it gives us two ways of using the associator to re-parenthesize expressions involving four terms. Now, it pains me that I sort of don't have enough time to do this, but I can't let you stare at this octagon and have no idea what it's related to. So I have to do it. I have to take some time to explain where this comes from. So this law turns out to be related to a higher dimensional braid equation. So if you can stand it, I hate not being able to give this the justice it deserves. But so first what I'd like to do is explain to you how braids are related to Lie algebras so that then I can hopefully give some motivation as to where this guy came from. So a braid is all about switching the order of two things. And in the Lie algebra, that's what the bracket does. It measures the difference between x, y, and yx. So it's not really surprising that braids and Lie algebras are related. In order to make that relationship precise, we need the notion of a Yang-Baxter operator. And so a Yang-Baxter operator is a map B that satisfies this equation here. Now, this definition makes sense in any monoidal category. Originally, mathematical physicists went looking for solutions of the Yang-Baxter equation in the category of vector spaces with its tensor product and obtained solutions coming from quantum groups. More recently, there's been interest in set theoretic solutions of the Yang-Baxter equation. That's something that I've been working on recently with Scott Carter and Masahiko Saito, looking at sets equipped with operations satisfying a self-distributive law that gave us set theoretic solutions of this equation. I'll put this back up in a second. If we draw B as a braiding, we see that the Yang-Baxter equation gives us what's called the third Rademeister move in knot theory. those of you who are unfamiliar with this braid equation might like to think of it as being about switching the order of switching things. So it's a crossing of crossings. We first switch the first two strands, slide the result, and then slide the result under the third strand because they're equal to each other. Well, the higher dimensional analog of this Yang-Baxter equation is the Zamolodnikov tetrahedron equation. Looks like this. If we use the analogy that this is a crossing of crossings, this is a crossing of crossing of crossings. So it's all about the process of performing this Yang-Baxter equation here. So if we look at the top center braid there and go down to your left, notice that the first thing that's happened is we've performed the Yang-Baxter equation, and then we take that and we slide it under the fourth strand. Going along the right side, what we've done is we've taken the threefold crossing, slid it under the fourth strand, and then at this last stage here applied the Yang-Baxter equation. So this equation says that the surface traced out by first doing the left side and then doing the right side is, well, that they're isotopic. Okay, so. I'm sorry, folks. I completely forgot to tell you why we even decided to talk about this. So the Yang-Baxter equation, or the third Rademeister move, involves three strands. The Jacobi identity in a Lie algebra involves three Lie algebra elements. It turns out that the Jacobi identity is secretly this Yang-Baxter equation, or third Rademeister move, in disguise. And so the higher analog of that statement is that this commutative octagon over here, the Zamolodnikov tetrahedron equation, turns out to be equivalent to this octagon here, the Jacobiator identity, in a suitable context. I'm sorry for ruining the punchline to the joke. Okay. Back to, let's leave this up for a while. Back to the Lie algebra, or the higher Lie theory story. Okay, so we can talk about homomorphisms and, yes, I'm sorry. And in fact, I'll say it in more than a couple of words in one slide. I should just look at him every time I am going to say what these things secretly are, because he seems to know exactly the slide that's going to come up next. Okay, so just quickly, if you are patient for just one moment. So a homomorphism of Lie 2 algebras, this is the Lie algebra analog of a monoidal functor. So what do we have? We preserve the bracket up to a natural isomorphism F2. That F2 then needs to satisfy a law of its own. So, you know, starring in the role of what used to be the associator is now the Jacobiator. So we get this law that needs to be satisfied. Of course, in a strict Lie 2 algebra, so a strict Lie 2 algebra is one of these semi-strict ones where the Jacobiator is the identity. So in a strict Lie 2 algebra, the top and bottom arrows are just equality. Okay. So maybe let's continue to leave this one up. So right, as was pointed out earlier, we saw that two vector spaces were just two-term chain complexes. So it's not surprising at all that these Lie 2 algebras, since their underlying structure is one of these two-term chain complexes, turn out to be related to Stasheff L-infinity algebras. So again, things are fizzling off at the second level, so we just get these two-term L-infinity algebras.
What does semi-strict
mean? So these are, well, these semi-strict ones are exactly these ones. Yeah, so I've just dropped the adjective semi-strict. These are the only ones that I'm talking about. So what, for those of you who aren't familiar with these, an L-infinity algebra blends together the notion of a chain complex and a Lie algebra. So it's roughly a chain complex equipped with a bracket that satisfies the Jacobi identity up to chain homotopy, which satisfies something up to chain homotopy, and on and on. So a one-term L infinity algebra is just a Lie algebra. So the simplest interesting ones are these two-term guys. Now, this theorem, this first theorem, is especially important for us in material that I'll be talking about later on, because what this is saying, I'm no longer live. Hello? Yes? Okay, so this theorem is going to be especially important later on because what it's telling us is that we don't need to work with the full-fledged morphisms in our Lie 2 algebra. We can instead just work with the corresponding arrow parts. So this first theorem tells us that it's Stasheff's idea of L infinity algebras, which is exactly the right idea for a categorified or generalized notion of a Lie algebra. And you know, this is somehow not surprising, right? Stasheff knew what he was doing, right? We have the A infinity algebras and E infinity algebras. The A infinity algebras allowed us to generalize a chain complex equipped with a multiplication that was associative. The E infinity algebras generalize both associativity and commutativity. So we're seeing that, you know, this is exactly the right thing to do here. The correct notion of sameness for Lie 2 algebras is equivalence, because there are categories. And so we're able to classify Lie 2 algebras up to equivalence in terms of Lie algebra cohomology. That is, in terms of a Lie algebra, a vector space, a representation, and a 3 cocycle. The representation comes from the bracket of an object and a morphism, and the 3 cocycle is secretly the Jacobiator, and the cocycle condition is secretly the Jacobiator identity. So the nice thing about this classification is it allows us to come up with examples of Lie 2 algebras with non-trivial Jacobiators coming from simple finite dimensional Lie algebras. Before I explain this, though, let me tell you a little bit about where this data in this theorem came from. So given a Lie 2 algebra, the way that we obtain this information was by looking at an equivalent skeletal Lie 2 algebra. So just as every category is equivalent to a skeletal one, that is a category where isomorphic objects are equal, Lie 2 algebras are equivalent to skeletal Lie 2 algebras. Lie 2 algebras are also equivalent to strict Lie 2 algebras, but it's often not the case that we can have them simultaneously be strict and skeletal. So we are going to constantly see this struggle between being strict and skeletal. This will come up again and again for the rest of this talk. So this 3 cocycle here, this last bit of data, it's the obstruction to making our Lie 2 algebra simultaneously strict and skeletal. And so we have this trade-off between having the Jacobiator be trivial, which would be the case in a strict Lie 2 algebra, and having the differential of our two-term L infinity algebra. Remember, the differential is the target minus the source. So in a skeletal Lie 2 algebra, the target minus the source is 0, so the differential is 0. So that's what we'll be seeing. Okay, so what we'd like to do is we'd like to cook up examples of Lie 2 algebras from this classification. And what we'd like to do is come up with one that's as nice as possible. So we're going to start with the nicest possible Lie algebra that we can think of, a finite dimensional simple one. So by our classification, in order to get a Lie 2 algebra, we need a vector space, a representation, and a 3 cocycle. Well, we could choose our 3 cocycle to be 0 and just take the first two bits of information up there. What that says is anytime we have a Lie algebra and a representation, then we get a Lie 2 algebra, but that's boring, right? We want something that has this interesting feature, the Jacobiator. So in order to find a non-trivial Jacobiator, what we need to do is we need to determine when the space H3 is non-zero. So by Whitehead's lemma, this happens when we have the trivial representation. This comes equipped with this God-given 3 cocycle nu, which is described in terms of the killing form. So what are we going to do? We're going to take this very nice finite-dimensional simple Lie algebra that we started with, together with the trivial representation, and k times this 3 cocycle involving the Jacobiator, and this is going to give us our examples of Lie 2 algebras called G sub k. So what we're seeing is that for every finite-dimensional simple Lie algebra, we get a one-parameter family of Lie 2 algebras, G sub k, that reduces to the Lie algebra we started with when k is equal to 0. Okay, so we have these very nice Lie 2 algebras, and the question is, does the same results that held for the strict Lie 2 groups and Lie 2 algebras, namely that every strict Lie 2 group has a strict Lie 2 algebra, can we get a corresponding statement for these semi-strict Lie 2 algebras? In particular, can we answer that question for these G sub k's? Well, this is going to require a weaker notion of Lie 2 group because, remember, these G sub k's are skeletal. They're not strict, so they can't come from a strict Lie 2 group. So what we need is we need some sort of weaker version of a 2 group, in particular Lie 2 group. So the candidate right now is something called a coherent 2 group. So coherent 2 group is a weak monoidal category where every morphism is invertible and every object is equipped with an adjoint equivalent. We have homomorphisms and 2 homomorphisms between them, and we're able to classify these in terms of group cohomology. This classification is completely analogous, but came first. So this was known and done, I can't remember by who, was it Ross? Or, oh, again, by this. Okay. So the classification, as I said, is completely analogous. We need a group, an abelian group, an action, and a 3 cocycle. The action comes from conjugating a object by a morphism, and the 3 cocycle is the associator. The cocycle condition is the pentagon identity. And again, this 3 cocycle, as before, is the obstruction to making our 2 groups simultaneously strict and skeletal. So every monoidal category is equivalent to a strict one. Every category is equivalent to a skeletal one. But again, we're seeing that we can't have both. We have this trade-off. This parallel classification suggests to us that 2 groups and Lie 2 groups, which I'll explain to you what that is in a moment, should behave similarly to Lie 2 algebras. Well, to the extent that group cohomology or Lie group cohomology resembles Lie algebra cohomology. Okay, so again, what are we doing? We're trying to find a weaker version of a 2 group such that its Lie 2 algebra is going to be one of these nice Lie 2 algebras, G sub k. So what's a coherent Lie 2 group? Well, we're going to use internalization in order to define that. So a coherent Lie 2 group, or Lie coherent 2 group, I don't remember the order of the adjectives here, is going to be a coherent 2 group object in the strict 2 category diffcat, whose objects are categories in diff, the category of smooth manifolds. So since we don't have a general construction of starting with a Lie 2 algebra and obtaining its Lie 2 group, let's try and just construct a Lie 2 group by hand such that G sub k will be its Lie 2 algebra. And we'll do this using the classification that was described here. So in order to do this, we need to understand the relationship between Lie group cohomology and Lie algebra cohomology. And these 2 spaces on the outer end of this this expression that's centered here, these 2 H3 spaces, they're not isomorphic. So again, we're going to try and copy the construction that we had of G sub k by hand. So we'll start with a very nice Lie group, simply connected, compact, simple Lie group. We'll take that as our space of objects. We'll look at U1 as the group of automorphisms of any object. We'll take the trivial action, and our 3 cocycle will be defined in terms of this where did it go? This God-given killing fund that we had before. So the question is, can we make this two group, G sub K, into a Lie two group? Meaning, can we make all of the maps involved be smooth? Well, G and U1 are perfectly smooth. We don't have a problem there. The trivial action is perfectly smooth. So the only question is, what about this associator, this three cocycle here? And it turns out that, unfortunately, we can't make this a continuous, let alone smooth. We can in the neighborhood of, a neighborhood of the identity, but not everywhere. So we are unable to make this skeletal 2 group, G sub K, into a Lie 2 group. But perhaps I was asking a bit too much. Right? We were looking for a Lie 2 group whose Lie 2 algebra was G sub K. But when in category theory do you do that? When do you ask that something be exactly equal to the thing that you're looking for? But what a better question is perhaps we're looking for a Lie 2 algebra that's equivalent to our G sub K. And that brings us to the good news. So for integer values of K, we have this infinite dimensional Lie 2 group that's going to save the day for us. So for Shay, it just means a nice kind of infinite dimensional manifold, so don't worry too much about that. But let me describe to you this Lie 2 group that's going to do the job for us. So since it's a category, I can tell you what its objects and morphisms are. So an object is a smooth path starting at the identity. A morphism is an equivalence class of pairs consisting of a disk and a unit complex number. Notice that this quantity here, alpha 2 over alpha 1, is independent of our choice of ball because this integral differs by 2 pi times some integer. And the resulting 2 group that we get inherits a Lie 2 group structure because the G that we started with was a Lie group. We can also describe this path Lie 2 group in terms of central extensions of loop groups. So an object is a smooth path starting at the identity, and a morphism then is going to be an element of the level K Kac-Moody central extension of loop groups. So let me just have up here these two descriptions of this path Lie 2 group. They're the same, right? They're describing the same thing. So again, the objects are smooth paths in the Lie group starting at the identity. A morphism, well, it's given by this semi-direct product where we take the action of base paths on this Kac-Moody group. And then I've defined for you the source and target and composition and identity. So you might want to compare these two descriptions of our path Lie 2 group. Maybe I'll leave up. This path Lie 2 group has very nice topology, so let me remind you a little bit about this trick for turning a category into some sort of topological group so that then we see how we get this, the geometric realization of the nerve is a topological group. So again, this was invented by Grothendieck taking the nerve. So we start with a category and we form a simplicial set. The zero simplices are the objects, the one simplices are the morphisms. John and many others this week talked about this. This is an idea you're familiar with. But since we're starting with a Lie 2 group, it's in fact a topological 2 group, meaning that the space of objects and the space of morphisms are topological spaces, and so we have a topology on the spaces of zero simplices and one simplices and so on. And so we can form a topological space in the obvious way, and since we have a group structure as well, it turns out that the geometric realization of the nerve is a topological group. So that's where that comes from. Let's see, what else? So we have that we also get a description of the string group. Where does the string group come from? Well, we sort of build it up starting from ON, the group of rotations and reflections. So ON is not connected. So what we'd like to do is look at the connected component containing the identity, SON. That's not simply connected, so if we look at its double cover, that's the group called SpinN. It has pi 0, pi 1 equal to 0, pi 2 is equal to 0 because it's a Lie group. Pi 3 is non-zero, so to kill off pi 3, what we get is this group string N. Moreover, this geometric realization of the nerve, the bars around this path, Lie 2 algebra, it's the total space of a KV2 bundle over G. Okay. Now I'd like to talk a little bit about how this path Lie 2 group does the job that we were trying to do. How is it giving us this equivalent Lie 2 algebra, or this Lie 2 algebra that is equivalent to G sub K? Well, it's because it's a particularly nice kind of Lie 2 group. It's a strict one. And as we saw at the very beginning, strict Lie 2 groups have strict Lie 2 algebras. They're easy to find just by differentiating. So what I'd like to do is explain the L infinity algebra, the two-term L infinity algebra corresponding to the Lie 2 algebra of this path Lie 2 group. And as I'm doing this, this will hopefully, for those of you who have not seen L infinity algebras before, give you an idea of the ingredients of a two-term L infinity algebra. So remember, it first and foremost is a chain complex. So we need zero chains and one chain. So the zero chains are paths in the Lie algebra G. The one chains are elements in the central extension of the loop group, so a loop together with a number. Since it's a chain complex, we need a differential. What do? We start with an element from the central extension. We throw away the number, and then we think of the loop as a path. Now we need to blend in the notion of a Lie algebra, and so we need something that serves the role of a bracket. That's what this L2 map is. So the bracket of zero chains is just going to be the usual bracket in the path, I don't have a good name for this, the path Lie 2 algebra or something like this. The bracket of a zero chain and a one chain involves an action of the central extension of the loop group. So notice in this formula what we have is the ordinary bracket, but then we also have the Katz-Moody 3 cocycle. Now remember, because this is strict, we're differentiating the strict Lie path Lie 2 group, and so when we have a strict Lie 2 group, or a strict Lie 2 algebra, its Jacobiator is trivial. The thing that's corresponding to the Jacobiator is this map L3, so that's equal to 0. The very nice Lie 2 algebras that we were talking about before, remember these are skeletal. So if we look at its ingredients, we see that the zero chains are just the Lie algebra, the one chains are real numbers. The differential, well again, because this is skeletal, because of this correspondence that's over on the board here, the target minus the source is 0, and so the differential is 0. The bracket is given by the ordinary bracket in G. If we want to take the bracket of a one chain and a zero chain, we use the representation. The bracket of two one chains would be a two chain, but we're chopping things off at the second level, so we don't have any two chains. And then we have this interesting Jacobiator, which is K times this killing form here. Okay, so let's compare these two a little bit. And notice that we really are, again, seeing this trade-off between being strict and being skeletal. So this guy over here is strict. It's L3 Jacobiator is 0, but it has many objects and many morphisms going between them. G sub k over here, well, it has an interesting Jacobiator. Its L3 is not 0, but it's somehow a deflated version, right? We have many fewer objects and morphisms. Notice that in some sense, these two balance. If we subtract off loops from the space of objects and the space of morphisms over on the right, then what we get is the objects and the morphisms over here. The other thing to notice is that G sub K is described by a 3 cocycle on G, whereas this path Lie to algebra is described by a 2 cocycle on loops in the Lie algebra G. Let's briefly look at the equivalence between these two. So we're going to look at the L-infinity algebra homomorphism, since I described both of these two in terms of the L-infinity algebras. And so, again, this is a map that's not going to preserve the bracket on the nose, but we're just going to look at things at the chain map level to avoid complication. So what does phi do? Phi is supposed to take a path and send it to a Lie algebra element, so we just evaluate our path at the endpoint. And phi sub 1, well, it's just going to throw out the loop. Okay. If we look at psi, we're supposed to start with a Lie algebra element and get a path. We're just going to construct the very boring straight path. And then we're going to send c to just a very boring loop here. Okay, so the upshot is this theorem, which gives us the equivalence between these two Lie to algebras. Okay. Let's see. So a couple of other things to point out. There has been another construction of this string group presented recently, maybe in November or so. Is that when we came across it? Yeah, so it was Friedrich, is that his first name? Friedrich Wagmann presented another method of constructing, or a different construction of a Lie to algebra that's equivalent but not isomorphic to our G sub Ks. And in addition to this story that I've told you about categorified Lie algebra, there are other versions of categorified Lie objects floating around. These are called Lie groupoids and Lie algebroids. Notice that they're appearing in the first row, second column of these charts. I'm not going to define what these are for you, but a lot of work has been done with these Lie groupoids and Lie algebroids, showing how to start with a Lie groupoid, what additional hypotheses we need in order to obtain a Lie algebroid. These are studied by folks up at Berkeley and some of the students of Weinstein from Berkeley. Okay, I should also point out that there is related work by Ezra Gessler, who's able to, for nilpotent, is it L-infinity algebras? Or L-infinity algebras, or integrate L-infinity algebras to get some sort of corresponding Lie N group thing. Something like that. And then also, as I told you, I wanted to share with you a little bit about what Andre said. So, and Andre's work is complementary to the work that I just described. So he likes to think of his work as generalizing integration. So starting with a Lie algebra and then obtaining the Lie group, whereas the Lie group's paper he sees as starting with a Lie group and getting a Lie algebra. So he sees them as being completely complementary. But again, the slogan that he wanted me to share with you all is homotopy theory enriched over the category of manifolds. So that was how he thought about things. And so His work gives a procedure that takes an L-infinity algebra and then produces a reduced consimplicial manifold, which is like a homotopy Lie group. And so he told me that, again, this is just via an email conversation that we had this week, he told me that his work was really motivated by his interest in orbifolds. And so he said that, you know, he thought about objects with non-discrete pi 1, which he thought of S1 gerbs over manifolds. So again, since I'm speaking about someone else's work, I don't feel at all qualified to answer questions or give any explanations. I'm just sharing with you what he wanted me to convey. And he later noticed that he said that standard S1 gerbs over a compact Lie group is itself a group object. And then he used these to produce some object that had pi 1 equal to a Lie group G and pi 2 equal to S1. And it was then later that he noticed the parallel story in the world of L-infinity algebras. So this is what he was thinking about, which motivated his work, whereas we were motivated by this very concrete question of trying to find the Lie 2 group associated to the Lie 2 algebra G sub K. So sort of coming at things from a different angle. These questions here are, you know, just things that remain outstanding to do. Danny, John, and I are currently looking at representations of Lie 2 algebras, in particular these Lie 2 algebras G sub K. I'm currently interested in this relation to the braid theory on these Lie algebra-like objects and higher versions of them and how they perhaps will wind up giving invariants of knots and knotted surfaces. That's where my interests are lying these days. And then, you know, all of these other questions about whether or not the material that I've presented to you is really the correct notion that we're looking for. So should we weaken the axioms of these strict two vector spaces, and will that do anything for the Lie 2 algebras? Will that sufficiently weaken the Lie 2 algebras? So notice that we weren't able to have a theorem that said that starting with a coherent Lie 2 group, we get one of these semi-strict Lie 2 algebras. So maybe the coherent Lie 2 groups are too weak, or maybe the semi-strict Lie 2 algebras are too strict. The idea was we should somehow be able to differentiate the Pentagon identity of the associator and obtain the Jacobiator identity. But, you know, it wasn't enough there. So one of these things needs to change a little bit, and we're not sure how to do that. So thank you very much. Yes? Can we maybe turn on the lights? Yes. Yeah.
Well, I have a question.
I don't know the answer to that, actually. So I didn't mention it, not because it's secretly lurking here and I just don't want to bring it up, but I don't know.
Because you have
concatenated
Lie groups, right. Sure. So I wonder why it's not part of the picture. Another question is, what about algebra?
Right, right. That's a good question. And
there is no A infinity hub. I see. In the literature, there is no notion.
People are doing this right now.
Okay.
Good. That's good to know. Thank you.
So maybe Merkulov had the right notion, but it wasn't in the center.
Okay.
Yeah, but these are comparison, direct comparison